The question, why me? Or, to put it in different words, why do the righteous suffer? Do bad things happen to good people? This question is a very painful one, and at times even a destructive one. And throughout the ages, throughout all the writings of the philosophers, in Torah sources, this question has always puzzled the philosopher who is searching for divine justice in the world. It has hurt the righteous, the good people, who are hurt when they see good people suffering or the righteous suffering. And for those who are sensitive, the question has actually destroyed them. It devastated them. They couldn't go on with their life, with their lives, when they saw people suffering. The question, do bad things happen to good people, demands two definitions. First of all, what do we mean by good people? And secondly, what do we mean by bad things? What is a bad thing, and who is a good people? Let's go in order of the questions and see if we can't develop some kind of an approach that will help us not only answer the question, but deal with the suffering in the world. When a person asks, why me? There's a negative side, a side that is not very helpful and does not lead to improvement or to growth. Why me? Now imagine that I'm asking this question out of pain. Something happened to me and it hurts. It hurts, and I'm in pain. And I say, why me? Why am I hurting? Why am I suffering? Now, the pain itself, although painful, does not create a legitimate question. To answer why I'm hurting will not take away the hurt. To know why I'm hurting will not make me any better, will not make me a better person. Pain hurts. It is not a philosophical issue, and it doesn't deserve analysis. So the destructive part of the question, why me, is not so much from the actual physical pain, but possibly more from the emotional pain. And that's the second part of the question. Why me? A person can be asking that. A person can be bothered by the question, why me, because he's interpreting, he's assuming that the fact that he is suffering, the fact that he is in pain, somehow implies that he is not a good person. So when a person says, why me, what he's basically protesting is his innocence. He's saying, why me? I don't deserve, or do I? If I am caused to suffer, if God is causing me to suffer, is he trying to tell me, is God saying that I am not good? Or does God hate me, that he does this to me? Or thirdly, has God abandoned me? Am I no longer under his care? Have I been rejected? That's the second possibility, the second meaning to the question, why me? It's an emotional one. I am hurt emotionally. I feel abandoned. I feel insulted. I feel accused. I feel guilty because the suffering seems to be implying that I am lacking somehow, that I am undeserving of good things or deserving of suffering of bad things. And even that is not the most destructive part of the question, the most negative. There's a third meaning, a third layer to the question, and that is, why me? It seems like God is playing with my head. Because a person has a certain view of life. He sees himself going in a certain direction. He has a certain sense of justice, and therefore life is good. He's got this all figured out. He looks at life, he looks at the world, he looks at himself, and it all hangs together. Maybe not perfectly, but it's working, it's functioning. Then something happens that is out of left field, totally unexpected, totally out of the script that he had written for himself in life. And this does something to his head. This is not an emotional problem. This is a disorientation in the mind. He no longer knows what's real. He no longer understands what life is all about. Because if this can happen, then where is the sense? Where's the rhyme? Where's the reason? How can life go on if things of this sort happen? And that's the explanation for Abraham's test. God tested Abraham 10 times, and the final test was, sacrifice your son. Bring him up on the altar as a sacrifice. And all the commentaries ask the question, where is the greatness of Avraham, where is the greatness of his sacrifice when God speaks to him directly, gives him a direct order, and tells him personally what he should do? Could anyone do otherwise? Do you have to be a patriarch? Do you have to be a saint? Do you have to be noble to follow, to obey a direct, clear, personal, face-to-face instruction from God? Did he have any other choice? Could he refuse God? Could anyone refuse God? So where is the greatness? And some of the commentaries say that the greatness is not that he obeyed, but that he obeyed willingly, that he bore no grudge. He didn't feel any resentment for having to do what he was going to do. But a deeper level, on a higher level, the real test, the real challenge, the difficulty for Abraham, for Avraham, was not the emotional attachment that he had to his son that would naturally keep him from sacrificing his son. It wasn't the sensitivity of the man who is incapable of hurting a fly and is told to do something so harmful and so hurtful to his own son. The real devastating challenge was that God had previously told Avraham that he would have a son, Isaac, Yitzchak, and that from this son a great nation will descend, and he will have many grandchildren. His children would be there, they would be as numerous as the stars, as the grains of sand on the beach, and so on and so forth. Now, God comes to him and says, bring your son Yitzchak as an offering, as a sacrifice on the altar. And Yitzchak hadn't even married yet. Now, Avraham's mind could have become, that was the test, he could have become disoriented, confused, upset, because he doesn't understand anymore what's going on. Yesterday you told me I would have grandchildren, now you tell me to end my son's life before he has any children at all. And yet, in passing the test, Avraham was not paralyzed by this contradiction. He didn't suffer in his head the disorientation that this apparent conflict should have created, would have created in a lesser person. So when we suffer and we say, why me? The most devastating part of that is that we've lost all concept. We've lost all of our picture, our view of the sense of life, of the direction of life. And then we just can't seem to get ourselves back together again, can't get back on any kind of a path to pursue life, to go on with life, because we don't trust it anymore. We don't know it anymore. We feel like a stranger in this world. That is the most devastating part, the negative side of the question, why me? What are the answers to these questions? If the why me is a physical complaint, I am hurting and I don't like it, for this you go to a doctor. Do something about the pain. Or learn to suffer silently. But you don't have a question. You don't have a real burning philosophical issue here. And therefore it won't be devastating. And when the pain is over, it's forgotten, it's gone. But what about the emotional part? When a person says, why me? I am not so bad. I never did anything so terrible. Why does God hate me? Or why has he abandoned me? We're assuming that when a person suffers, that suffering is a form of punishment. It's been a traditional answer for a very long time that no one suffers unless they deserve. The Talmud says that you don't stub your toe accidentally unless you deserve somehow to feel that pain, and that in feeling that pain, you gain forgiveness, you expiate some sin, some fault. In fact, if you reach into your pocket for a nickel and you come out with a quarter and you have to reach into your pocket a second time to find that nickel, the frustration, the bother, also is a form of punishment and brings forgiveness for some sin. But that's not the only type of suffering. We make a mistake when we assume that all suffering is punishment for sin. Punishment for sin is only one type of suffering, and it is only one of the many explanations and possibilities that explains the suffering in this world. Not that we ever have enough explanations to satisfy the question. Most suffering is simply a divine mystery. We don't understand it. Because in order to explain the suffering and dismiss it as punishment, the suffering has to fit the crime. A stub toe, we can match a crime to that. A headache, we can match a crime to that. But can we match any crime, any sin, any violation to a Holocaust, to genocide, to innocent children being hurt or killed, God forbid? There is no crime that fits that punishment. And therefore, that suffering cannot be explained as a punishment. There must be some other explanation. Either we will find the explanation, or it will remain a puzzle. So when a person says, why me? I am suffering emotionally. I'm taking this as a rejection from God, abandonment from God. He hates me. He's punishing me. May not be true at all. Not all suffering is a form of punishment. Particularly when we look at other people's suffering, it is a virtue to be able to accept our own pain with dignity by saying, I must have done something to deserve this. But it is no virtue at all to look at someone else's suffering, to look at your neighbor's suffering, and to say, well, they must have done something bad. God knows what he's doing. He's punishing them for some sin. It's okay. That is not only not a virtue, but that's actually the ultimate sin, the ultimate crime. Because in the Torah, in the Bible, we find constant statements that say, if you see your neighbor suffering, you must intervene and somehow ease the suffering or eliminate it completely. It is no virtue to explain someone else's suffering in the name of God. So to say every person I see suffering must deserve it because it is a punishment is really an ungodly and immoral attitude. We have to recognize right from the start that ultimately, no matter what we explain, no matter how much we understand, we're not going to fully plumb the depths of God's judgment. because we simply don't have access to all the information. We don't know what came before, and we don't know what's going to follow. And so we are really not in a position at all to judge God's justice. Now, when a child is told to do something that an adult would appreciate, the difference in their maturity, which is really just a few years of life, that difference is great enough, is big enough, to have the child misunderstand an adult's kindness and take it to be some kind of a punishment or some kind of cruelty. When the child says, "Why can't I have another ice cream? You're mean." Well, but the parent is not being mean. The parent is being responsible and therefore kind. So the difference of a few years of maturity that separates the child from the adult is enough to make them misunderstand each other, to be miscommunicating, to be so far apart that what is kindness to one is perceived as cruelty to the other. And if that's true between two human beings, how much more so when we're talking about how God takes care of us and how God treats us, can we even dare to attempt an explanation? Yet we have to live with it. And so we do have to respond. We have to know how to deal with God's justice, even when we don't understand it. What we know about God is what he wants from us, but how he runs the world, this we can only respond to. We can't really grasp it. Are there bad things in God's world? We have to understand that a person who asks this question is asking it from a religious perspective. Who asks, why do the righteous suffer? Who is bothered by this question? If I am not righteous myself, then I'm really in no position to ask that question. Because the question, why do the righteous suffer? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why me? That question is a moral outrage. It's an expression of moral outrage. I am hurt. I am expressing a discomfort with what I perceive to be an injustice. When God came to Abraham and said, "I'm going to destroy the city of Sodom," he argued with God. But is this justice? But is this right? What if there are a few righteous people in the city? How can you destroy them all? And should they not all be saved in the merit of the righteous? He argued. Where did that courage, where did that outrage come from? It came from Abraham's righteousness. He was righteous and therefore pursued righteousness and could therefore justifiably say, "But this is not right. This doesn't sound right." When God came to him and said, "Sacrifice your son," he didn't argue with the instruction and with the commandment. But when he heard that God was going to destroy others, and this didn't seem right to him, he argued. But if I argue that the suffering in the world upsets me, makes me uncomfortable, I object to it, I have to make sure that I am righteous enough to be moved by other people's suffering, to be moved by injustice, or what I perceive to be an injustice. And only then can I morally make that objection and ask that question. There is something in us, some righteous instinct, some sense of fair play that tells us that good guys should not suffer, that good guys should not finish last, And it's that moral impulse, it's that sensitivity to justice, to righteousness, that makes us uncomfortable, that brings us to ask the question, why do the righteous suffer? But if I don't believe in justice, if I don't believe in righteousness, if I don't believe in goodness, then what is the question? There was this woman who I had ongoing debates, philosophical, theological discussions with, and she always took the position of an atheist, agnostic. She's not sure there is a God. She doesn't believe in God. She doesn't want to believe in God. When her brother died, a young man, she kept repeating the question, why him? He was so good. Why him? He deserved to live a long life, a good life. Of all the people in the world, he was the best man I ever knew. Why him? And finally, I challenged her with the question, of whom are you asking this? To whom are you complaining? If you don't believe in God, you can't ask that question. If you don't believe in God, then what is his goodness? What is the fact that he was a good man? What does that have to do with having a heart attack? If you're going to object on the grounds that he was a good person, then you are assuming that there is a judge, that there is a master to the universe, and that this judge is righteous, and that he rewards the good and he punishes the bad, and that your brother was good and yet was not rewarded or was actually punished. If you believe in God, then that question is legitimate. But if you claim not to believe in God, then where is this moral indignation coming from, and at whom are you angry? So the impulse, the instinct, the sensitivity that disturbs us, that makes us ask this question, why do the righteous suffer, is based on, number one, a belief in justice, number two, a belief in a judge who enforces that justice. But number three, it is also based on the assumption that people are good. When you say, why do the righteous suffer, you have to believe that the sufferer is righteous. If you believe that people are righteous, if you see goodness in people, and therefore believe that they are deserving, then the question of the righteous suffering becomes a legitimate one. Concerning the Holocaust, or human suffering in general, there are two responses that are quite popular. One response is a traditional one, and the other a more contemporary one. The traditional response is that human suffering is due to sin, caused by sin, and the suffering cleanses us, purifies us, brings us forgiveness for the sin. And so the Holocaust, the great tragedy of 6 million Jewish sacrifices, is explained by some authorities as being punishment for sin. The more contemporary response is that the Holocaust was caused by unknown forces. God does not make Holocausts. God does not cause suffering. God does not prevent suffering. God cannot stop the suffering. God comforts and supports those who suffer. These two answers fall short in some very important ways. In one case, in the traditional answer, that a Holocaust is a punishment for sin, enables you to continue believing in God, even after a Holocaust, by putting the blame on the victim. Is God guilty of an injustice? God forbid. Not at all. The Holocaust was deserved. There were sins. People were not behaving the way they should. And so that brought the Holocaust. People will behave themselves, and then there will be no Holocaust. So we have salvaged our faith in God. We can continue to believe in God. We can continue to pray to God and trust in Him. But we have created for ourselves a cruel God. The other answer, the other response, the more contemporary response, also enables you to salvage your faith in God. You don't have to be angry at God. You don't have to disassociate yourself from God and refuse to worship Him because of a Holocaust. And the reason is, He is not to blame. God doesn't do Holocausts. God doesn't stop Holocausts. That's not His department. And so you've salvaged your faith in God, but you now believe, and you have now created an impotent God, a God who is not the master of the universe, but merely an ingredient in it. A good ingredient, a comforting ingredient, but only one ingredient of many. The question, why do the righteous suffer, assumes that there is a judge, and that He is all-powerful. He is the master of the universe, and therefore all that happens in this world happens by His plan, by some vast eternal plan. And if that plan doesn't seem right, just, or moral, then we complain to its architect, to its master. We complain to God. Everything that happens is part of that plan, including a Holocaust. Therefore, we demand of God an explanation, a justification, or an end to the suffering. And we do not blame the victim. If you're going to ask why do the righteous suffer, you obviously believe that the sufferers are righteous. When suffering happens, how do the righteous handle it? Why do the righteous suffer is a good question. How do the righteous suffer? You think about the great people you've known, the people you admire greatly, the people who you're in awe of. These are people who have suffered greatly, and yet they're bigger than life. They inspire those around them in the way that they suffer. How do the righteous suffer? Well, let's start with, why me? When a righteous person suffers, does he have that question? Is he bothered by the question of, why me? Here's how the righteous would handle that question. If a person suffers, personally, not when he sees others suffering, when a person suffers personally and he asks, why me? His answer to himself is, why not? Do I deserve better? Can I demand more? Can I expect more? Do I have grounds on which to object to the way my life is unfolding? If the suffering that I am experiencing is due to my sins and to my failings, then that punishment to the righteous is fully acceptable and even welcome. Because when God punishes, the punishment heals. It does not destroy. There's that famous analogy that Hasidic philosophy gives us. It's about a boy who is running around barefoot. And his father says to him, don't run barefoot, you'll get a splinter. And the child says, I'm not afraid. So the father says, but it'll get infected. It might get infected. The child says, I am not afraid. I don't scare easy. And he runs around barefoot, and sure enough, he gets a splinter. And he neglects it, and it gets infected. And his foot is so infected that it's in danger. It needs to be removed. But they rush the kid to the hospital, and there's a great doctor there, and the doctor saves the foot. Child heals, and he's running around barefoot again. Father says to him, don't run barefoot, you'll get a splinter. He says, oh, I'm not afraid. He said, but it might get infected. He said, that doesn't scare me. So the father says, but then we'll have to take you to the doctor and he will heal your foot with those sharp, cold blades that cut and hurt. And the child says, oh, okay, now I'll go put on my shoes. That scares him. This is a child. The child is not afraid of the damage. The child is afraid of the cure. But an adult shouldn't have that reaction or that response. When God says in the Torah, don't do such and such, and if you do, this is the punishment. We say, well, I'm not afraid to do it, but I am afraid of the punishment. To avoid sin out of fear of punishment is childish. The punishment is the cure. The sin is the damage. When God says, for this sin there is this punishment, he's saying that if you do this kind of damage, this is what it will take to correct and undo the damage. So are we afraid of the undoing, or should we be afraid of the damage itself? A righteous person is not uncomfortable with divine punishment, because divine punishment is healing. Divine punishment fixes what was damaged. The thought that I deserve better does not occur to a righteous person. In fact, the difference between Yaakov and Esav, the twin brothers, Jacob and Esau, one was righteous and one was not. Every kindness that God showed to Esav made him more arrogant, more demanding, feeling more deserving. Whereas with Jacob, with Yaakov, every kindness God showed him humbled him, because he felt more and more in debt, more and more undeserving. And therefore he said, when he succeeded and came back from Lavan's house, wealthy and with a large family, he said, Kotenti mikol ha-chasadim, I am humbled by all this kindness. I feel small. How will I ever repay such a debt? What happens when the righteous suffer? They allow the suffering to humble them. If the suffering is not a punishment, if it can't be attributed to any sin or guilt, then the least we can do is allow the suffering to have a positive effect. And the positive effect is humility. The righteous are humble. There are two possible attitudes, assumptions. One, a popular attitude, is that in life, in this world, you deserve the best. But don't have too many expectations, because you'll be disappointed. Feel that you deserve. Have a high self-image. Feel that you have earned and deserve all the best things. Great success, great health, great popularity, great wealth. But don't expect it, because if you won't get it, and chances are that you won't get it, you'll be devastated, you'll be disappointed, and it will ruin your life. So here are the two ingredients for a successful life, for a happy life. Feel very good about yourself, feel deserving of everything, but expect nothing so that you won't be disappointed, so that you won't be shattered. A more righteous attitude, the attitude of the righteous, is the exact opposite. In this world, in God's creation, we deserve nothing, because life itself is given for free and is undeserved. Just by existing, we are already indebted to God. That too is free. And so everything beyond that, everything in addition to that, cannot be demanded or argued on the grounds that we deserve, because we've done nothing to deserve. I've done nothing to deserve. And on the other hand, when I go about my business, when I go about my life, I am to expect to succeed and to have the best that the world can offer. So my expectations are very high, but my sense of deservedness is very low. I deserve nothing because God brought me into this world without my earning it. And yet I expect everything because God is kind and God gives to those who don't deserve. That is the more righteous attitude. Particularly if we put ourselves into the proper context. Imagine if you're sitting in somebody's house and they're serving you a six-course meal. And at the end of the six courses, you feel like a little dessert. You like to have maybe a little pie, maybe a little ice cream. And to your surprise, to your utter shock and amazement, your host tells you, or your hostess tells you, that there is no dessert. Can you imagine yourself getting upset? Can you imagine yourself becoming morally indignant? Can you imagine yourself pounding on the table, demanding dessert? How can you not serve dessert? Where is my dessert? It's unthinkable. Not because you're a saint, not because you suffer silently, not because you're stoic, but because it's not your house. If in your own home, sitting at your table, eating your own food, you are somehow told that you can't have any more, or you can't have seconds, or there will be no dessert, then maybe you would be justified in pounding on the table saying, "Where is my dessert? This is my house." But if you're in somebody else's house, you don't rush into the kitchen and yank the refrigerator open and help yourself to dessert and feel completely justified because you've had six courses and now it's time for dessert. In somebody else's house, they decide what it's time for, what comes next, and what doesn't happen. So if we remember simply that we did not create the world, this is not my creation, this is not my kitchen that I'm living in, this is not my vast eternal plan that I am living through, then if God gives me six courses but no dessert, I am not indignant. I do not scream, "Why me? How could you do this to me?" Because I'm simply conscious of the fact that this is not my kitchen. I was in England not long ago talking about this subject. And at the end of the talk, this woman approached me. She hadn't left her house. She hadn't left her living room for over a year, since the time her child died from leukemia. This was the first time she had gone out, because the title, "Do Bad Things Happen to Good People," which was the name of the talk, was something she needed to hear, and she decided that she was gonna come and listen. Anyway, she approaches me and she says, "And what if your child dies of leukemia when she's 5 years old?" Well, I asked her about the child. What was she like? How did the child handle her own suffering? After all, it was the child that suffered. And as I expected, she says, "The child was magnificent. You would never know that she was in pain. You would never know that she expected to die. She was full of life, and she inspired everyone around her more than most people." So you might say that in the 5 years of her life, of her short life, she affected more people than the average person affects in a long life. And she affected them more deeply, more profoundly than most people will affect others in 70 or 80 years. She was a magnificent person, which of course makes the tragedy all the greater. But in talking to this mother, I finally said, you know, if God had come to you and asked you, had presented it to you and said, would you mind being the mother of a little girl who will live for only 5 years and will then pass away from leukemia? You would have said no, wouldn't you? That's why he didn't ask you. Because had you said no, you would have missed out on an incredible experience. And she agreed. The righteous suffer righteously, and we are all inspired by it. Even a child can inspire the adults around them because somehow they see clearly. Somehow they are not tortured by the confusion, by the contradictions, or by what we sometimes feel is a personal affront. God is insulting us by causing us to suffer. They feel none of that. In fact, they don't think they're suffering at all, and that is the ultimate righteousness. A man came to the famous Magid of Mezrich, the master of Mezrich, and said, can you explain to me how we are supposed to accept suffering graciously? How can a person be grateful, as the Talmud says, for their suffering? And the Magid said to him, For an answer to your question, you must go to my disciple Reb Zusha. He will give you the answer. And so he journeyed to Anapoli, to the village where the famous Reb Zusha lived, and he introduces himself and he says, I've just come from the Magid, from the teacher. He sent me to you. You should explain to me why or how the suffering can be accepted graciously. Now, Reb Zusha was a very poor man, and it had a very difficult life, a life full of suffering. When this man says to Reb Zusha, the master sent me to you because you can explain to me how to accept suffering graciously, Reb Zusha was genuinely surprised. He says, are you sure you were sent to me? I have the answer? I don't understand. How can I explain how to suffer graciously when I have never suffered? Nothing bad has ever happened to me. The man understood that that was the answer the Magid had sent him to hear. The righteous don't suffer silently. They don't bite their tongue. They don't forgive God for causing them to suffer. They don't see the suffering at all. Because whatever happens to them, they're in God's kitchen. And if the meal is one course, they're grateful for that. If the meal is a half a course, they're grateful for that. Life itself is a gift. Life itself is already more than we deserve. We love our life. The righteous choose life, as God instructs us to do. And so life is good. And if there is pain in life, it means that life is not better than good. But good is good. And so they don't feel that the lack of dessert is some kind of an injustice or an evil that should not have happened. Which leads us to the question, the ultimate question. Are there really bad things? Do bad things actually happen? The righteous don't think so, but we need to understand how that is. Do bad things actually happen, not only to good people, but do they happen at all? We've already spoken about the fact that when a person is being punished for their sins, in other words, they were not completely good people, and so they are being punished for their sins, then that punishment, like the healing of the infected foot is not a bad thing at all. In fact, that's good, that's just, that's kind, and that saves the foot. And so the punishment for those who are not such good people is not a bad thing, and it's not happening to a good person. So the question of do bad things happen to good people seems to imply that bad things happen and they're happening to the wrong person. But do bad things happen at all? To appreciate that, to understand that, we have to understand a little bit of the nature of divine providence. We're sometimes confused by the contradiction, or the seeming contradiction. If everything is planned out in advance, if everything goes according to a divine orchestrated plan, then where is my freedom? Where do I get to choose? How am I a free agent if all my experiences, if all my behavior is already predetermined? The answer to that is that the freedom of choice that God gives us is a moral freedom. We are morally free. No force, no compulsion in the world can cause me to sin unless I choose to do so. And nothing can force me to be good unless I choose to do so. But where do I sin? Where am I good? In the context of some event. If I find some money lying on the street, will I return it to its owner or will I pocket it and walk away? But what caused me to find that money? What caused the owner to lose it? These are not moral questions. These are the contexts that set up a moral choice. And then the moral freedom that we have enables us to go one way or the other. So God plans out all the events. Whatever happens is a context in which I can make a moral choice. And when I make that moral choice, then I am exercising my freedom. But the events themselves, I have no control over. That is the divine plan. The Baal Shem Tov taught that every event, every movement in the universe is part of that divine plan. When in the autumn a leaf falls from a tree and is carried by the wind from one spot to another, that's by divine plan. Nothing would happen. No leaf would grow and no leaf would fall. No leaf would be carried by the wind without it being a specifically planned detail in God's divine providence. And so everything that happens to me is part of that plan. And when I am faced with that part of the plan, I am given a moral freedom to make a moral or immoral choice. If I am in pain, that pain is divinely planned. How I handle that pain, that's where my choice comes in. Knowing that everything that happens is part of a divine plan, that it is coming from God, helps us understand a little bit why we sometimes experience pain and think that it is bad when in fact it is not. Hasidic philosophy explains it this way. There is the revealed world and there is the concealed world. In the revealed world, there is a kind of a kindness, a form of kindness that God gives us, which we recognize immediately as being pleasant and kind and gentle. That's coming from the revealed world, and therefore we perceive it as kindness. It is revealed to us, and we accept it as such. Then there is the concealed world, according to the Kabbalah. There's the concealed world from which God sends us kindness, only this time the kindness will not be revealed to us. We will not perceive it as kindness. And it will be uncomfortable, and we will therefore mistake it for cruelty, for suffering, for bad, inappropriate. By the way, when we say bad things, we don't mean painful things. Pain can be good. A bad thing is not something that hurts. A bad thing is something that should not have happened. Something wrong, something went amiss. That's a bad thing. Now, knowing that everything comes from God, either from the revealed world or the concealed world, makes all events, regardless of their nature, a little bit more tolerable, a little bit more acceptable. It is easier to suffer knowing that there is a purpose to the suffering than when we don't know, when we're not aware of any purpose. A mother in labor experiences great pain, but the pain is understandable because we know where it's leading. We know what the outcome will be. Not that there necessarily has to be pain, but when the pain is within our picture of reality, then it is easier to tolerate than a pain that is a mystery. Knowing that everything that happens happens as part of the divine plan, that itself already makes it easier to tolerate the discomforts in life, because they're not bad, they're only painful. There's the famous rabbi of Berdichev who wrote this song to God. It's called You, in which he sings of God's omnipresence, how God is everywhere and everything. And he says, east is you, west is you, up is you, down is you. When things are good, it's you. When things are not so good, it is also you. And as long as it is you, it is good. Which is a step further, a second step. The first step is there is a plan, there is a reason, and that itself makes the pain a little bit more tolerable. In addition to that, it's not just any plan. It's not just that it has a reason. It has a divine reason. God has a reason. And God is good. And therefore the reason is a positive, good reason. And so if it's coming from God, it is by very definition a kindness. Why then do we experience it with so much difficulty? Why is it so hard to tolerate, so hard to swallow? Because it's coming from the hidden world. Now, to take this concept of the hidden world, revealed world, and to bring it down into simple language so that we can really understand it. When you're talking to your spouse, to your in-laws, to your neighbors, to your boss, there are two things going on at the same time. A revealed world and a concealed world. The words you hear from those people, from the people you're talking to, the words you hear, that's the revealed world. When a person says, I like you, I think you're great, I respect you, I admire you, I love your company, that's the revealed world. The concealed world is, what are the thoughts going on in that person's mind as they speak to you? How many times have we been hurt, devastated by something a person said to us, which caused us to hate them, to reject them, to resent them, to avoid them, to go to war against them? Because we heard them say hurtful things, negative things, vicious things. Then we find out that we misunderstood. What we thought was their intention wasn't their intention at all. It was a mistake. The words were misunderstood. Obviously, the problem comes from the fact that we cannot read another person's thoughts. It's the concealed world. That which we do not know will sometimes interfere with what we do know. So when we hear words, but we don't know what's behind them, we can sometimes get into trouble. What God does for us is the revealed world. That's like speaking out loud. But what is God's intention? What did he mean with that? This we don't know. This is the concealed world. If we could know what God is thinking, if we could know what he means by it, we would not see anything as negative in God's world. There would be nothing wrong. There are no bad things in God's world. The Rebbe once explained a little incident that the Bible describes, where Joseph was standing at his father's deathbed, Jacob's deathbed. And the Torah says that Jacob said to his son, his favorite son, "I know that you have a hard feeling in your heart over the fact that I buried your mother on the side of the road," because Rachel was buried on the side of the road and not in the family burial space in Hebron. "So I'm going to explain to you why I did that before I pass away." And Yaakov explained that there will come a time when the Jews will be leaving Israel, being taken captive by the Babylonians and led into captivity, and they will be taken down this road, past the grave of their mother or grandmother, Rachel. And they will have the opportunity to stop and pray at their mother's grave to be saved, to be protected during their exile. And that will actually enable them to survive the exile. And that's why I buried her at the side of the road. Now, the Rebbe asked, isn't it strange, inappropriate, that this most devoted of sons, who loves his father dearly and respects him and admires him, he was not only his father but also his teacher, and here, at his deathbed, Yosef is harboring hard feelings against his father, so that his father feels compelled to justify himself and to explain himself to his son. How could this be? How could Yosef question his father's judgment in burying his mother at the side of the road? And the Rebbe explained as follows. The hard feelings doesn't mean that he doubted his father. A person who knows that there is a certain justice going on in the world, there's a certain plan, there's a certain balance of things where everything in the end works out right, and yet he looks at life and nothing looks right. Nothing seems to be balancing out. And so he develops a hard feeling, but not a feeling against God, not a resentment or a complaint, but rather a prayer. Can I not be allowed to see the truth that must be there? Yosef didn't doubt for a moment that his father's wisdom was keen and on target, and that if he buried his mother on the side of the road, there must be some incredibly important and just reason for it. And yet he looked at his mother's grave, and he couldn't see the justice, and he couldn't see the reason. And it bothered him, not what his father did, but that his father's wisdom is so much greater than his own, that they end up existing in different universes. What is good and just and right, by his father's reasoning, by his father's standards, seems the exact opposite to him. So they're not thinking alike. They're not on the same level. His father is much higher than him in his perception of truth and reality. And therefore the hard feeling was, will I never see what you see? Will I never understand things the way you understand them? So Yaakov says, before I pass away, I will elevate you one more level. I will share with you one more insight. I will bring you up to the view, to the perspective that I have concerning your mother's burial, so that we can be on the same wavelength, so that we can see it the same way, so that we can share that same knowledge. And the same is true with praying for good things. Knowing that everything happens by divine plan doesn't stop us from praying for change in that plan. For example, we know that every person who is hungry, every person who is poor, is experiencing those things as part of the divine plan. And yet, we intervene. We are to feed the hungry, we are to support the poor, so that the hungry are no longer hungry, and that the poor are no longer poor. When someone is not well, we pray for their recovery. This is not a rejection of the divine plan. This is simply to say, we understand that God sees more than we see. God knows more than we know. But can't we bring it together? Can't God's wisdom, can't divine knowledge be brought down to our level so that we too can see the wisdom? And can we not be elevated to a higher level so that we have the same perspective as the divine plan has? So the prayer, the hard feeling that Yosef had, was not questioning divine justice, but rather yearning, praying, to be able to perceive that, to see that which is part of the hidden world, and bring that hiddenness into the revealed, into the open. The divine plan is sometimes very mysterious, sometimes not so mysterious. When Yaakov says to his son, Jews will be taken into captivity and they will need to go past their grandmother's grave so that they could pray for it, for their survival. That was not going to happen for many generations. It was a long time in coming before the act of burying Rachel at the side of the road was justified and served its purpose. Sometimes it doesn't take that long. There was that incredible incident with a flight, an airline flight from Chicago to California, I believe it was. There were two little incidents connected to that airline tragedy. It took off from, I think it was Chicago or Detroit, I don't remember. And within 15 minutes it crashed and there were no survivors. But there were two little incidents here. One incident was that this guy shows up at the counter. He has a reservation, but he's told that they overbooked and that he's being bumped off the flight. He is beside himself. He is upset. This is terrible. He needs to be in Los Angeles. He's got to get there. He's going to miss his appointment. It's going to be a disaster. And so he is upset that being bumped off that flight is a tragedy in his life. It is ruining him. It is destroying him. This is the worst day of his life. And he didn't keep it a secret. He let every agent know that he's very upset. There was another incident of a father and his teenage daughter on the way to the airport. The daughter was going to fly off to Los Angeles. On the way to the airport, the daughter says, you know, I really don't want to go. I'm afraid. I'm nervous. I don't want to go. And the father says, don't be silly. You're not a child anymore. You'll get on the plane. It'll be fine. And the daughter says, no, I'm afraid. I don't want to go. And the father, doing his fatherly duty, encouraged her to get on that flight, reassured her that there was no danger, told her that airline flying is safer than driving, with all the arguments that we're all familiar with. And he succeeded. He succeeded. He was a good father. And he put her on that flight, and sent her off to that vacation. 15 minutes later, the plane crashed, and there were no survivors. Now, it took only 15 minutes for the man who thought that this was the most disastrous day in his life to realize that for him, not getting on the plane was the greatest kindness. It actually saved his life. It took only 15 minutes for the father who put his daughter on that plane to realize that it was a tragedy, not a victory. The divine plan was suddenly revealed within 15 minutes. That which was hidden was suddenly revealed. We don't know, we don't understand the divine plan. How can we? We're trying to figure out not only what God said, but what he was thinking. Sometimes God reveals his thoughts. Other than that, thoughts are unknown. We cannot know. What we do know is that no event, no incident is ever an oversight. Nothing ever happens by accident. Nothing ever happens by coincidence. And nothing ever happens as an indirect result of something God had planned. Every detail is part of the plan. And that knowledge itself is very comforting, very reassuring. We don't need to know everything. We don't need an explanation for everything. We just need to know who is in charge and what kind of a plan are we part of. A divine plan, a plan that promises ultimate goodness in the world, revealed for everyone to see and understand, then I want to be part of that plan. There's a famous little story about this couple, a married couple who one was blind and the other was deaf. And they lived in perfect harmony because the deaf one didn't know how vicious the spouse was, what a vicious tongue they had, because didn't hear anything. And the blind one wasn't bothered by how ugly and deformed the other one was, because he could see nothing. And then a doctor came to town who could cure everything. And he cured the blindness and he cured the deafness. And they went home thrilled. A few weeks later, the doctor shows up at their door and wants to get paid. And they attack him. They say, "We should pay you? You ruined our lives. We were so happy before you came along," etc., etc. The doctor says, "Oh, I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to ruin your lives. If it's really that bad, why don't you come back to the office and I will reverse the operations. I will make you blind again and I'll make you deaf again." And to this they said, "Oh, no. They certainly don't want that." So the doctor said, "In that case, pay me." We can look at life and say, "I object to this, I object to that, I can't stand this, I can't stand that. Cure me, fix me." In God's world, everything has its purpose. Knowing that we are part of a divine plan makes life itself precious. We don't want to give it up. With all of its pain, with all of its difficulties, if we know that we are part of a vast eternal plan, we don't want to give that up. And something in us, something righteous and moral and strong and sensitive in us says, life is bigger than what meets the eye. Giving that up is unthinkable. And therefore, the difficulties are justified as part of that package. The righteous do not suffer because life is worth living. And every time something bad or painful happens, their appreciation for life gets deeper and bigger so that it envelops even the painful parts. It envelops even the disappointments and the hurts, and just makes life that much more precious, that much stronger, that much deeper. the righteous accept their pain and their discomforts graciously, either because of their humility or because they simply do not see anything bad happening to them. This is appropriate and virtuous only when we're talking about our own suffering. It is magnificent when we see people who, from our point of view, are suffering unbearably, and yet they smile through the whole thing. And they're concerned with how you feel, and they're trying to make you comfortable. We're in awe of such people, and that's appropriate. But to use that same reasoning when it comes to other people's suffering, this would be the ultimate immorality. When we see other people suffering, no justification is acceptable. No explanation makes us more comfortable with their suffering. And we remain indignant, morally outraged, that they, who are so righteous and so deserving, are feeling so much pain or going through so much suffering. That, in a nutshell, is morality. Morality means, I don't deserve, I have no demands, I am eternally grateful for whatever God gives me. And on the other hand, I cannot explain, I cannot understand, I cannot accept any explanation for why the person next door or the person sitting next to me should ever suffer at all. That makes a moral, righteous person. There's one angle of this whole subject that we need yet to cover. It's understandable now that all things that happen are part of a divine plan, and therefore, even when things are not so good, as the Bodhicitta said, as long as it's you, it is good. But what if my suffering isn't coming from a divine event? If it's not coming from an act of God, so as the insurance companies call it, what if it's coming from my neighbor? What if I know who it is who is causing me to suffer? And it's a human being who has freedom of choice and chooses maliciously to cause me to suffer. How do I handle that? It's one thing to be angry at God and to say, God, why do you do this to me? It's a completely different thing to feel that there are people causing you to suffer, that there are human beings who have freedom of choice, who are choosing to make your life miserable. What do you do with that? Now, again, there are those who, for religious reasons, will say suffering is good. If you can suffer silently, then you are strong and virtuous. And so accept the pain, let people hurt you, let people insult you, let people make you suffer, but suffer silently. That attitude is completely unacceptable. If people want to excel at tolerating pain, that's their privilege. But it's not a proper attitude. There's a famous joke about these two guys in the hospital. They both have gout, and they're both suffering. It's a very painful condition. And the doctor comes in to examine them, and the examination is extremely painful, excruciating. Doctor comes into the first guy in the first bed, and he examines him, and this guy is stoic. This guy can handle pain. This guy can tolerate incredible amounts of pain. But the gout is too much. And after 15 minutes of controlling himself and biting his tongue, he finally screams in agony and can't take it anymore. The doctor then goes to the second patient in the second bed, and he's examining him, and he's probing, and he's pushing, and the guy is completely calm, the patient completely calm. The examination lasts 15, 20 minutes, and the doctor leaves. And the guy in the first bed turns to the guy in the second bed, and he says, "That's incredible. I've never seen anyone tolerate so much pain as well as you tolerated it. What religion are you?" So the guy in the bed says, "Oh no, it has nothing to do with religion. I'm Jewish. I don't like pain. I gave him the other foot." We don't believe in suffering, but suffering well. We don't make suffering a virtue in and of itself. So when someone is causing you to suffer, what do you do with that? Maybe a little difficult at first, but when we think about it, if you are feeling pain, if you are feeling an embarrassment, if you are feeling a disappointment, a frustration, that is an event similar to the leaf falling off the tree and being carried across the street by the wind. And just as the movement of the leaf is part of a divine plan, the pain you are feeling is part of the divine plan. The fact that it was caused by the guy next door, the fact that you were hurt by a person, by a human being, doesn't change the divine plan at all. If it came through the human being was the vehicle, the agent, that brought that suffering or that pain or that discomfort to you. But the suffering itself comes from God, not from a human being. Let's put it quite strongly. No one can cause you to suffer. No one can cause you pain. No one can kill another person, interfere with another person's life. No matter how much freedom of choice God gives us, it does not include the authority, the right, or the ability to in any way infringe on another person's existence. There was this incredible little incident back in Brooklyn where a classmate of mine was walking home one Friday night when he was mugged. This juvenile delinquent jumped out from the bushes and said, "Give me your money." And Friday night, of course, he wasn't carrying any money because it's Shabbos. This guy pulled a gun. They were standing not 2 feet apart. And he said, "Give me your money or I'll shoot." And for some reason, this friend of mine couldn't believe that this was actually happening. Guns and shooting, it just didn't register. And he simply dismissed it. He said, "Go away, leave me alone." This kid pulled the trigger and ran. My friend walked home. He walks into the front door, and his wife is horrified because of all the blood that was all over his beard and his jacket. He hadn't even noticed. What happened was, according to the doctors, the bullet hit his jawbone at a certain angle and flattened against the bone and went no further. They determined that they weren't going to take the bullet out. They were going to leave it there for some reason. I don't understand all of that. But here was a guy who was shot point blank by someone who intended to kill him. Obviously, if you buy a gun and you point it at someone and pull the trigger, there can only be one intention. So here, this juvenile delinquent had his freedom of choice. And he made a very immoral choice. But he was exercising that freedom that God gave him. So he went and he purchased the gun, found himself a victim, pointed the gun at the victim, pulled the trigger at, and shot his victim. But that's where his freedom of choice ended. Now the question is, this guy walking down the street, is he intended to die that day, or is he intended to live a long and happy life? The freedom that the juvenile delinquent had cannot impose itself and interfere with another person's life. And so what happened was, he ended up with a bad headache. How many times do the the bungling criminals, the famous gang that sets out to rob a bank, but they get a flat tire on the way, or they get stuck in traffic, they take a wrong turn. The fact that you have the freedom of choice to make an immoral decision and act on that decision does not guarantee you a victim. We are not victims of each other's immorality. Immorality hurts only ourselves. Now, this doesn't mean that the murderer is not guilty of murder and that he can argue that the fact that the victim died was obviously part of a divine plan, because if he wasn't destined to die, then the bullet would have gone flat against the bone and he would have had only a headache. The murderer chose to be a murderer. And it's that choosing, it's that freedom for which we have to answer for. That's what we are responsible for. That's where our innocence or guilt lies. So if someone pulls a trigger and the victim dies, then the murderer is a murderer. In fact, if the victim doesn't die, then the guy who pulled the trigger is a murderer in spirit. He intended to kill, and that's really all he can ever do. So he went to the full extent of his freedom of choice to be a murderer. And for that, we are morally responsible. But the victim has his own plan. The victim has its own destiny. And what was meant to happen to him is what's going to happen, and nothing else. And therefore, when Joseph's brothers came down to Egypt after they had sold him into slavery, and after he had spent time in the prisons there and suffering and so on, now he was the viceroy of Egypt, and the brothers come down to Egypt to buy bread from him. And they're really convinced, absolutely certain, that Yosef will take revenge, will get back at them. And so they say to him, please, when Yaakov passes away, and they felt that now their father gone, Yosef might decide to take revenge. And they say, please, don't be angry at us, don't take revenge. And he says, revenge? Angry? I have no reason to be angry at you. Although your intentions were bad, but God's intentions were good. And so in effect, Yosef is saying to his brothers, you did not have the best of intentions when you sold me into slavery. And for this, you have to do some soul searching. You have to get that thing cleared up in your own mind, in your own heart, in your soul, and you have to settle that. It's between you and God. But what happened to me came from God's plan. And God's intention was for the good, so that I would become the viceroy here and save people from starvation and provide food for the entire region. So what Yosef is saying is, if you try to harm me, that's your problem. You are an immoral person. You make immoral choices. You make wrong choices. You've got negative, distorted feelings. You're out of line. There's something wrong with you, and you got take care of it. Do something about it. But whatever happens to me, even if it comes through you, is happening to me because of a divine plan, because of God's purpose, not because of your purpose. And back to the Holocaust. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust because Hitler and the SS and the Nazis decided to kill Jews. Now, what are we to make of this? My grandmother, who died in the Holocaust, she was a victim of Hitler's whim. She was a victim of Hitler's evil, his cruelty. Is that what life amounts to? Can one person's whim, can one person's distorted feelings, can one person's wickedness snuff out another person's life? Can we really say that because God gave Hitler freedom of choice, that's why my grandmother died? There's no justice to that. There's no sense to that. And it isn't true. There's a divine plan. And if someone dies even the most insignificant being, that death came as a result of a divine plan. When a cow chews on a blade of grass, that blade of grass came to its fate by divine plan. Certainly, when a human being's life is ended, it is part of some bigger picture. It is part of some divine, majestic plan, not ever the result of another person's poor choices or evil instincts. Can we explain the Holocaust? Why was there a Holocaust? Why does a child suffer? Why do some people die young? We have no explanation for it. And we accept no explanation for it. Because having an explanation would not make us better people. It would not enhance our lives. It would not make us more moral. It would not make us more sensitive. On the contrary, any answer to human suffering that makes us comfortable, that reassures us, that enables us to go to sleep peacefully while people are still suffering, is a step towards immorality, not a step up, a step down. No answer should be acceptable. Because the question ultimately of why do the righteous suffer is not a question that begs an answer. It's an objection that demands change. The righteous should not suffer. And whatever virtue suffering brings, can't that same virtue be acquired without the pain? No pain, no gain. That may be true, but why should it be true? And if it was true until today, does it have to be true tomorrow also? If suffering is some kind of a virtue, and if it makes people better, and it does, if it ennobles our lives, and it does, if it somehow brings out the best in us, and it often does, well, fine, but is that how we're going to be ennobled tomorrow? Is that the only way to bring out the best in people? In God's infinite wisdom, can't there be another way? And so until there is another way, in other words, until the world is perfect, until Mashiach has come and the world becomes sane and healthy and utopian, we have an objection. There must be a way to elevate people, to bring out the best in people without causing the pain, without the hurt. Until then, as long as there is suffering, we need to allow the suffering to bring out the virtues, to bring out the goodness. There's the famous story of one of the disciples of the Maggid, who as a child was orphaned from his mother. His father remarried, and his stepmother was very, very cruel. She had three children of her own, and let all her frustrations out on this poor child, blamed him for everything that went wrong, hit him whenever she was upset, and so on. He grew up to be a great saint. But when he was a disciple, when he was a student under the Maggid, he was traveling to Mezrich to be with his teacher. It was a long journey. And along the way, he met a saintly-looking man, and they began a conversation, a very learned conversation. And he was so impressed with the knowledge, the wisdom, the scholarliness of this man that he had met, that they sat for hours, forgetting that he was on his way, that he was traveling, and he was lost, completely absorbed in the wisdom that this man was sharing with him. Finally, it came time to leave, and he says to this man, he says, "Where did you learn this great wisdom?" And he says, "Well, I can't really tell you, but if you're interested, I'm on my way to my teacher. Come with me." And the chassid said, "Well, I'm on my way to the Maggid, who is my teacher, and I'm not sure that I could go with you until I get permission." He was sorely tempted to accompany him. And he said, would you wait for me here, and I'll be back, or tell me where to meet you. I'll get permission from my teacher, and we'll get together again. He says, no, either come with me now or forget it. He struggled desperately within himself until finally he decided that he couldn't do it without permission. And so they parted. He came to the Magid, and he told the Magid what had happened. And as the story is told, the Magid said to him, you should know that that was not a human being, that was a demon, disguised as a scholar. And had you gone with him, you would never come back. You'd be lost. Your life would be over. In fact, the Magid said to him, I know that these demons are extremely attractive, irresistible. Where did you get the strength to say no? And he thought about it for a while, and he said, I think it was my stepmother. He remembers coming home one day from cheder, from school, and he found four portions, three decent portions and kind of a leftover piece. Knowing that the leftover piece was his portion, he was being very hungry, he ate it. His mother came home and saw that he had helped himself to that portion, and she beat him severely, all the time screaming at him, even a good thing you don't take without permission. And somehow that left a deep impression on him, and it was that enabled him to say no to this very tempting, irresistible charm of this demon. The Rebbe then said to him, the Magid then said to him, do you now understand the benefit or the purpose of suffering under a cruel stepmother? There is always some kind of a virtue. There is always some kind of a strength that comes from negative experiences. They are there, and they have to be put to good use until such time as all tears will be wiped away from all eyes, and we will suffer no more. In the meantime, suffering humbles us. It only reminds us that we are human, that we are frail, that we are in God's kitchen, not in our own, that there is a divine plan that is beyond our understanding because we only see a little piece of it at a time. It puts things in perspective for us, and at the very least, it should make us more sensitive to someone else's suffering. At the very least, it should make us more sympathetic to other people's discomfort, even small discomforts. At the very least, having felt the sting of pain and of tragedy, we should be extra careful to make sure that we don't cause anyone else any kind of pain, any kind of discomfort. So we may never fully understand why the righteous suffer. We may never fully explain whether bad things happen to good people, why bad things happen to good people, do bad things happen to good people. But this we are capable of doing, and this, if we did, would make the world so much better. Bad things happen to good people. What's the explanation? How do we justify it? How do we handle it? We may never know. But we can make sure that we are never the bad thing happening to good people.